Tuesday, August 20th, was a day of excitement and upsets. I had expected to be in Washington all week by myself. Instead, Lyndon had arrived after a speech in Detroit to the veterans of foreign wars very late last night. I had spent all Monday in intensive work on the business I had come for, filming the family floor of the White House. On Monday, it was the West Hall, our living room. I was considerably upset because Lyndon's presence means that we won't have the freedom of the place. It must serve his uses. As it turned out, his uses were to sleep briefly, telephone at length, and go straight to his office. There was an air of excitement, more than usual staff coming and going, a feeling of tenseness of something about to happen. I deliberately did not try to find out just what was afoot. There was talk of a press conference, which was to be on Wednesday morning. In asking Walt Rostow about some future dates for visiting chiefs of state, I did say, "Is there anything good going to happen in the next day or two?" In his quiet but humorous fashion, he said, "It looks like the Russians have emptied their out-basket to us. They've answered all the president's correspondence." I spent the morning going over the script for the Yellow Oval Room in the West Hall, worked with Bess, and then did some filming in my lovely bedroom, silent, just sitting at my desk, and so managed to get a good deal of work done, autographing, reading memos, consuming the read and file. I had lunch alone in my room. Lucy had come up with Lyndon. That easy, adaptable little girl had packed, picked up her baby, left on short notice for a trip by Detroit, and on to Washington for one day or one week. All travels with Lyndon are open-end. She, too, was excited. She was working on her book about Yuki. She hoped to go over it with some of Lyndon's staff and maybe get it to the point of presenting it to a publisher. In typical fashion, getting ready to be a young career woman, she had gone out and bought herself a briefcase. She arrived in Lyndon's bedroom with a sack labeled Princess Grace and brought forth from it a rainbow-striped briefcase, exceedingly feminine. Proudly said to her daddy, "How do you like it?" He looked at it and said, "What is that, a diaper bag?" I never saw a more deflated little girl. And then we all rocked with laughter. Lynn has been called Lyndon's vice president in charge of happiness, but his mother has had that job a long time. In the afternoon, I went over the script for the treaty room filming, and we shot about 2 hours of film in that overpowering old room where so many of my projects have come to life. And then, just before 4, I broke loose, dressed up in a pretty summer print, and met Jane and Connie Freeman for pictures in the West Hall, and then stood with them at the door of the Yellow Room for tea in Connie's honor. She is to be married on Saturday. I will not be here for the wedding. Her parents are just about my favorite members of Lyndon's cabinet. In these years, I've come to feel so close to them, and it was a happy pleasure to extend this little bit of gaiety and warmth for the wedding of a daughter of a friend. Most of the cabinet wives were there, 9 of them, and Muriel looking lovely, and the members of Connie's wedding, bridesmaids, school friends, fellow Peace Corps members. One of the signs of the times was 2 young girls standing together in the Yellow Room of the White House. One, a Peace Corps friend of Connie's, very black, very bright, very outgoing. The other, the very blonde daughter of Marvin Watson from Dangerfield, Texas. We had delicious refreshments and went out on the Truman balcony and talked about weddings, and it was over about 5:30. And then I settled down at my desk for work on the Christmas list and a talk with Lucy about her book. She is by turns elated and deflated. I think it shows a certain fresh talent, a light, amusing touch that is distinctively Lucy, and I find it easy to quite honestly buoy her up. Simone came over, and we worked on the scripts for the filming. And then, close to 9 o'clock, the Bill Whites arrived on the second floor. Lyndon had called them, but it was a good while before he came. We had a good visit, turned on the TV. Secretary Rusk was testifying before the platform committee of the Democratic Convention, chaired by Hale Boggs. We were listening to him when Lyndon came in, and moments later, there was a dramatic turn of events. He was making a statement on Vietnam, a strong, clear, tough, to me, effective statement. He was to answer questions afterward, and then someone came up to him and handed him a note. about the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Russians. He asked the committee's pardon, turned to go. Hale Boggs read the note. There was a churning air of expectancy, excitement in the room. Lyndon had learned about it only a short while before. And what events would follow in its train? Well, first there would be a National Security Council meeting, which he had already called. Lyndon asked for his supper to be brought in on a tray. He ate hurriedly, and then went back to his office. The Whites and I talked for a while, discussing the portent of all that had happened. I, at least, foreseeing only dimly. And then I had a massage as was in bed by midnight, knowing that this day would shape much of the days that were to come, but not how. Lyndon's 60th birthday, on Tuesday, August the 27th, was probably as strange and dramatic and in a way sad birthday as any he'll ever have. For me, it was a sort of suspended in space time this whole week. The decision had been made irrevocably on March 31st, but somehow there was a special saying goodbye this week to our whole political life. The convention would be choosing from among others, and for us it was over. No matter that it was happily, cozily over by choice, there was still a special aura. There had been talk about going to the convention to make a sort of a valedictory speech to receive good wishes on our birthday, Lyndon's birthday, I mean. No decision. And gradually, as the days passed, my betting was more and more that we would not go. And when the convention virtually erupted on Monday, the chances of our making the trip seemed to me to dwindle to almost nothing. It had grown so exciting Monday night that I had stayed up until 3 o'clock, I who loved to go to bed early. But when some forces had had the presumption to contest the seating of the Texas delegation, I couldn't possibly have gone to bed until John had won that fight. So, on Lyndon's 60th birthday, I woke to a sense of void and yet excitement. Talked to Linda at the White House, to my office. They read me a letter from Mrs. Dick Daly asking me to be her guest at a special luncheon any day during the convention. I called her to thank her and say that we had no plans to be there. I walked down to the birthplace for exercise and to be alone. Came back to find the press was intent on getting a birthday picture of Lyndon and that he thought to avoid having 30 or 40 of them out at the ranch, we would fly into Austin, go by Lucy's house, and let them take pictures there of all the family present, just the four of us, cutting a cake. And what a whirl of activity that threw us into. Lucy, who has a remarkable ability to rise to the occasion, said, yes, of course, she could drive in, get her house cooled off, arrange for enough cake and coffee and cold drinks for 50 or whatever they were, while she was getting ready and calling two or three friends to rush to her rescue, I called the always resourceful Wheezy Deeth to get several cases of soft drinks, round up coconut and chocolate and rum cakes, and come as soon as possible to Mackin Place. Lyndon had been swimming with Jake Pickle. We had Mary bring out to the pool a cold lunch for our small household, and then Lucy and Lynn left. And with all vestige of any possible trip to Chicago ruled out, I began to call our close friends, all of whom were really standing by, to come on over and celebrate our birthday with us tonight. The Morsons and the Winters and the Wests, who would fly up from Houston, and the Thornberrys and the John Hills. Jake Pickle's wife would come back with us from Austin. Jesse Kellum and Jesse Hunter. The Ernie Stubbs. And staff members Marie and Jim and Larry and Tom Johnson. Liz called from Chicago to report that it had been a wonderful women's luncheon, the style show, with Abigail, Muriel, and Mrs. McGovern, all seated at the head table, and Bess Abel, darling as Dolly Madison. Even Liz sounded glad that we were not in Chicago, however. From afar, it seemed like a seething cauldron of emotions and striving cliques, of every stripe of Democrat, and hippies and yippies and police standing by. If I could have been there without being me, I would have liked very much to see what is looming up as one of the spectacles of our time. We left about 5 o'clock by chopper, Lyndon and Lynn and Jim and Marie and I, and landed at Camp Mabry and drove into Lucy's house. Like magic, Lucy's friends had converged and spread the table with a beautiful array of cakes and polished candlesticks and newly shined silver and wedding present china and a great variety of soft drinks, which is quite natural in Lucy's household, but perhaps not exactly what the press is used to. They arrived in very full number, considering that the big news was more than 1,000 miles away, and Lyndon sat on the sofa, and Lucy brought in his cake with one candle on it. He took Lynn on his lap, and later the press recorded him, very much to my pleasure, as looking tan, lean, and fit, in a brown short-sleeved shirt, open at the neck and matching slacks. He cut his cake and gave Lynn a piece, who promptly began making a mess, but Yuki helped clean it up, usefully eating all the crumbs. He had brought in 3 of Lyndon's presents, which he opened there and shared with the press. A small watercolor that Lucy had made of Lynn by the artist whom I had to paint her when she was less than 2 years old. How she had found her, as reasoner she was then, I do not know. And Linda had arranged to get, all the way from Peru, I think it was, a fur-covered pillow. Perhaps it is llama, but at any rate, the softest, most luxurious fur I nearly ever felt. And I, for once, had a real present for Lyndon, a lifetime present. A watercolor of Linda, done in one of her elegant trousseau dresses, a white satin encrusted with a wide collar of brilliance, and which, amazingly, she could still wear when 7 months pregnant. It was the work of Madame Shumatoff, and worth a sizable piece of an Alabama farm. The press, oddly rather subdued, asked Lyndon a few questions. He talked at length and in mild good humor. It was all very low-key, which somehow, in a way, added to the sad atmosphere. We choppered back and were at the ranch by 7, and with the long twilight, Lyndon set out at once for a ride, and I to change clothes and get ready for the birthday party. Linda Bird came in at 8. I went out to the runway to meet her. And then the convention news started, and with all 3 TV sets going. In the living room, we stopped to greet all our good friends, and then to turn our faces back to the TV. The wildness in Chicago. All of us, more than 20, congregated in the living room, and we simply couldn't break it up for dinner. Finally, I had Mary put the dinner out on the big buffet in the dining room, and as we wished to, we filed in, filled up our plates, came back, and took our seats, and watched the spectacle. It was indeed a 3-ring circus. There was a Stop Humphrey movement by McCarthy and McGovern, and the Draft Teddy Kennedy movement, with the TV commentators running in a circle from one Kennedy supporter to another, trying to stoke the fires under it. And you would think that there were no delegations to the convention except New York and California, and I believe Wisconsin. And then finally, the forces of the South moved in, and favorite son delegations began releasing their delegates to go for Humphrey. First Texas, and then South Carolina and Tennessee, and the convention moved on to a bitterest fight of all, a crucial one, the Vietnam plank in the platform. And so, in spite of all the hell raised on the floor and in the city, the work of the convention did go on, and a credit it was to those there. Linda and I were so amused at the reporting of Buckley and Gore Vidal that we called communications and asked them to record them for us so we could look at them later. And we all sat and watched until very late. This was to be a series of nights of eating off our laps while we watched TV. And even after most of the guests left, some of us stayed and watched. And so this strange day came to an end. In fact, a whole strange week it was, characterized by Lucy as the longest wake I ever attended. This August, we have spent more time at the ranch than any I can remember, except perhaps around Christmas. Lucy lets me read her letters from Patrick and listen to her tapes. He seems so young and vulnerable and good, and I am afraid for him. Oddly, more than I am for Chuck, who is in more danger, but somehow I expect him to be able to handle it. Less often, Linda lets us read her letters or listen to her tapes from Chuck. She holds her personal life close,
He flinches when her daddy quotes him, I think. But every quote is something you can be proud of. And so, we go on through this strange year. And personally, it is a happy year within the close circle of our family. Because I think we are proud of what each one of us is doing, all of us together. How strange that might sound from somebody on the outside who is looking at us. Yes, true, the world is undergoing convulsions all around us. Our party, our country, the whole world. And it seems to me London is plowing right along, working as hard as he can every day on those things he can control, and assaulting those things most vigorously that he has even a little hope of controlling. I know it is a racking year for London physically, and it must be mentally and spiritually. And sometimes I think the greatest courage in the world is to get up in the morning and go about the day's work. That is one of the things I like about him. He keeps on and on and on.